We're talking with Congressman Chris Cox, representative from Irvine, a Republican. Why are you worried about John Graham's campaign? Are you not worried? You're going to win anyway, right?
Well, as a United States representative, I'm focused, as you might imagine, on doing my job, representing Orange County and California in Congress, and that for particularly members of the House of Representatives amounts to the modus operandi for any successful campaign. We have an election every 2 years, and the voters get a chance every 2 years to either give you a vote of approval or to trade you in for a new model. Doing the job well is the best, most effective way of running a campaign, actually.
So you're not worried about his campaign?
Right. I don't think in politics, in sports, in business, in academics, or any other pursuit, it makes a whole lot of sense to worry about what your competitors are doing. You've got to worry about doing a good job yourself. I have more than one competitor in this election, and each of them has his reasons for running, and they make their case to the voters, and I make mine. But in my case, my main objective is to represent Orange County's values, which are, you know, entrepreneurial spirit, opportunity to go out and earn a living for your family, find a job, start a job, be able to contribute to the community in both public and private ways, and to have a good quality of life, to protect our environment here and to make sure that our country is safe and secure. Economic growth through lower taxes and a moderate level of government regulation that is successful in achieving our public purposes but doesn't stifle growth and opportunity, that's essentially the agenda that I'm pursuing in Washington.
How do you react to his argument that you're an 80s person, that your argument is all 80s and he's from the new Orange County?
Well, I guess I'd say I'm younger than he is. I don't know exactly what that means, but I'll say this, that my background in Orange County was in high-tech finance, in venture capital, and a lot of the entrepreneurial startups that have really blossomed over the last decade or two in Orange County. We have become, as you know, a center, and UCI is a big part of this. We have become a center for not only high-tech, but also biomedicine, for genetic research, for medical equipment. There is really no aspect of the 21st century economy that isn't very firmly anchored here in Orange County, and that's been my background before I came to Congress. And since I've been working in Congress, I have been chairing the Policy Committee in the House of Representatives, which is a forward-looking enterprise. We focus not on how to solve problems with yesterday's tools and yesterday's solutions, but how to do things in a better, more effective way for the future. I've also spent, as he has, some time as an academic. I was on the faculty at Harvard Business School, as perhaps you know.
Yeah.
And there, I taught federal income tax. We have a lot to do with tax policy in Congress. We write the nation's tax laws, as you know. And I will never forget the ultimate wisdom that I acquired from one of my students after a very arduous course. This is a 5-credit course, not just the usual 4 credits. I administered an exam that was 2 questions, 4 hours, 2 questions. And because this is Harvard Business School, it's the case method, of course.
Right.
These cases were constructed to contain every known tax problem, you know, completely nefarious exercise to make sure that, rather artificially, these 2 business problems were just loaded with tax issues. And so the students filled up a lot of blue books. But there was one student who wrote just 1 blue book, and I was very anxious to read this model of concision to see how it was that he could answer all these problems in just 1 blue book. When I opened the cover, I found he had only written on 1 page. And here's what he wrote. He said, "Dear Professor Cox, what I've learned in your course is that federal income tax is extraordinarily complicated, and when I go into business, I'll be sure to hire someone who knows what he's doing in this area. the kind of wisdom that sometimes we need to get from our students. I had to flunk him, by the way, but he probably went off and started at .com. But the truth is that the tax code is extraordinarily complicated, and all of the fine-tuning that people want to do back in Washington misses the main point, which is that ordinary Americans have to hire help in order to fill out their tax returns, and when they call the IRS, they can't even get a straight answer.
Do you think that you're going to win by a larger margin this time, or what?
One never knows, particularly when every 10 years our districts are redrawn. We've just been through the decennial census, and following that census, the state legislature drew new boundaries for the state legislative and the federal congressional districts. And so the district that I ran in 2 years ago and the district that I will run in now are different voters, different cities. Some of it is the same, but portions of it are new.
It's still
so it's a little bit of an apples and oranges comparison if one wants to say, well, you get the same percentage of the vote that you got last time.
Well, who got more than the Republican registration last time, I guess?
Yes, I ran ahead of Republican registration. I always...
No, he did.
Pardon me?
He did. I thought Democratic... he did. He got ahead of Democratic registration, I mean.
Yes, and I got ahead of Republican registration because, as you know, the decline to state is a big portion of the electorate and oftentimes the deciding factor in elections. But I got a significant share of the Democratic vote as well, and I always aim at that because the job is not to represent just Democrats or just Republicans or even people who decline to state, but to represent Orange County.
Do you think it's unfair then to blame you for the Cox report?
I'm not quite sure that isn't a loaded question. I'm not sure that there's blame to be assessed, but if not credit. But the name of the committee formally, and I think this is why it ultimately got shorthanded to the Cox Committee, was the Select Committee on U.S. National Security and Military Commercial Concerns with the People's Republic of China. It was created by a vote of the entire Congress, and the members were appointed by the Speaker of the House and the Minority Leader, Dick Gephardt. The committee reached unanimous conclusions and published its findings in a top-secret classified report, portions of which were declassified, and all of those findings then made the basis for recommendations also contained in the same report. 28 recommendations of that select committee have been enacted into law and executed by the administration, the most significant being the creation of the National Nuclear Security Administration, which took over responsibility for nuclear weapons security from the Department of Energy, which by all accounts had done a substandard job. And I think that those are very, very important achievements, very important accomplishments. But to the extent that there is credit or blame to be shared, I think it has to be shared with all of the members because we had a joint work product in which we all participated. The Clinton administration also participated very substantially because our staff, who actually wrote the report, I didn't, of course, write the report, our staff were provided almost entirely from the Clinton administration, from the FBI, from the CIA, and from the Pentagon, and all of these people who, of course, possessed the requisite security clearances and so on, collaborated in the writing of the report. And we voted to approve it, but that was the source of the information.
But you don't agree that it was racially profiling Chinese American scientists?
Well, of course not. I mean, anyone who read the report would know that that is the case. What the FBI did tell us during the course of that investigation is that the People's Republic of China is in fact the government. Is involved in some racial profiling that they in fact target. Asian Americans or Chinese expatriates for recruitment purposes. But the United States government does not do this, and certainly if such activity were to occur, it would be outside the bounds of what is accepted in the United States, and such activity should be strongly condemned in all quarters, and I would certainly condemn it.
But didn't this report lead to the persecution of Wen Ho Lee?
To the contrary, the Select Committee did not, in fact, mention Wen Ho Lee in our report, either in the classified version or the unclassified version. His name was not even known to the Select Committee, which completed its investigation in late 1998.
But on page 40, you do mention that of that report, chapter 1. I believe you do mention that Chinese Americans, that you said the Select Committee has received information about Chinese American scientists being identified in this manner by, I guess the report is saying that they're targeted for recruitment by Chinese government. And
yes, as I mentioned, the FBI reported to us that the People's Republic of China, the government of the People's Republic of China, does in fact target Chinese Americans and Chinese expatriates.
All governments do that, right? Or don't you think all governments spy on each other?
Whether our governments spy on one another seems a different question, but I would agree with that. Yes, there's a great deal of espionage that occurs in the world, and it's not limited by any means to the People's Republic of China.
What do you think of the Privacy Act? That's come under attack since 9/11, and the director of the National Security Agency now is arguing that maybe the military should be, or the NSA should be able to collect, signals intelligence on U.S. citizens within the U.S.
I've been very active in the Congress in seeking to ensure that as we fight the war on terrorism after September 11th, we keep our focus on why we're involved in this conflict. We are trying to protect freedom in this country, and we are not, it seems to me, well advised to emulate the government conduct of those people that oppose us. We should not become a police state in the interest of protecting ourselves from other police states. I think that the main reason that some of the people, Al-Qaeda, for instance, have such hatred for the United States is that we are free in this country to express ourselves on subjects that they don't agree with in ways that they would object to. And were they in charge, we'd have a theocracy here that told us all we couldn't speak that way. And so I want to make sure that our government agencies don't think that they can have a new charter now of spying on Americans in ways that we've always thought intolerable.
Well, I'm glad you say that, because I actually had a case against the CIA for collecting information on me, and we settled out of court. They paid the ACLU $46,000, and they admitted that they conceded that they wouldn't do it again. There is this provision in the Privacy Act that says that permanent residents and U.S. citizens, U.S. government cannot collect or retain information relating to First Amendment protected activities of these people. But apparently the CIA thinks that the National Security Act, which allows them to collect counterintelligence material, trumps the U.S. Privacy Act, even though the NSA doesn't seem to think that.
I think that you're on solid ground there, if I understand your description of your case,
right.
because there are very tight strictures on, in particular, the Central Intelligence Agency conducting activities within the United States.
Right.
Counterintelligence, frankly, falls largely outside their domain, and is rather the province of the Department of Justice and the FBI. And if nothing else, at the Department of Justice, they have plenty of lawyers who understand fully the restrictions on law enforcement in the United States.
So you would agree that it shouldn't, there were hearings in Congress that you would argue for, to keep the restrictions against spying on American citizens locally?
Yes, I would. In fact, I published an article in Forbes magazine after September 11th outlining my position that we need to maintain our freedoms in this country, and we don't want to erode our First Amendment rights, our privacy rights, or our protections from government snooping in an effort seemingly to protect ourselves from governments that would, if they were to take over the United States, impose these things on us.
How about the people, the Americans that are being held without lawyers? What do you think of that?
Well, the policy committee, which I chair, has made human rights the centerpiece of its global agenda. We have a domestic policy agenda, which is about 50% of our work product, and foreign affairs, international relations, national security agenda, which is the other half. And with respect to that latter, human rights has been our main occupation. I am very, very concerned that whether it be a Democratic administration or a Republican administration, we always keep human rights in the forefront of our geopolitics. You know, if we become such realpolitik aficionados that we don't have space or room in our thinking for human rights, if it's not sufficiently pragmatic, then I think we will have lost our way. And so the policy committee's main role is to inject that into all our discussions, because we do, after all, have an armed services committee that thinks mainly about force structure. We have an international relations committee that thinks most of the time about the balance of power and who are our friends and allies and so on. But we've got to have a constancy of focus on human rights. And so when people, particularly American citizens or American residents, permanent resident aliens, are being held anywhere in the world without their basic human rights, without counsel, without lawyers, then we need to speak up in their behalf.
So have you spoken to the Bush administration about that?
Indeed. In fact, even today, just before we began this interview, I was writing a letter back to the State Department, one of several pieces of correspondence. I've also had many telephonic meetings and in-person meetings about the case of Christina Fu's husband, Yang Jianli, who's been detained in the People's Republic of China since late April without counsel, without any access to lawyers. He is one who was banned from returning to the People's Republic of China because he had participated in the Tiananmen Square demonstrations. His wife's a U.S. citizen. He has family here in the United States. And when he went back, they picked him up, and they've been holding him incommunicado since early this spring. I and other members of the Congressional Human Rights Caucus have been very active in this case. Representative Barney Frank, who you may know from Massachusetts, and I just held a news conference on this case, as a matter of fact.
Were you involved in helping the case in the case of the AIDS activist in China who was detained for a month?
That's correct.
Yeah. Were you involved in that case?
As well. Yes. In fact, we are urging the administration to raise these specific names, as many of them as we have, in every top-level meeting that they have with the People's Republic of China. We happen to be talking about China, but our human rights agenda is by no means limited to the PRC. We have issues with virtually every non-free country on earth, and it's very important, as I say, to keep human rights in the forefront in each of these relationships. And, you know, Saudi Arabia is a particular example these days because we are seeking the support of the Saudis with our Middle East near crisis at hand. And yet, we don't want, for purely pragmatic reasons, to look the other way as human rights abuses occur. I mean, we're trying to fight, and by fight I don't mean just militarily, but also diplomatically. We're trying to fight for certain basic principles here, and we've got to keep those principles always in focus. So with respect to Saudi Arabia, just as an example, one of the things that I have been doing is working for internet freedom so that men and women in Saudi Arabia can have access to news and information, that the government can't censor them or censor materials to which they seek access or censor their communications among one another. They've got to have an intellectual freedom of the mind, and we've got to stand up for that. People are often imprisoned for violating these rules, and I've even introduced legislation, the Global Internet Freedom Act, that would put the U.S. government on the side of those who are seeking to avoid the censors.
But so do you think it's a human rights abuse to have Americans detained without the right to lawyers?
Yes, of course.
So you agree that they should have lawyers, these two people that are, you know, they were profiled in the New York Times story yesterday?
You'll have to tell me what the story you're referring to focused upon, but...
The military is arguing that these were, one was a combatant that they supposedly caught on the battlefield, the other was not, but a group of civil rights people, including, I think, conservative groups, have gone to court arguing that they are entitled to, they're both American citizens, Yasser Hamdi and another person who were detained, Jose Padilla, and they, you know, they don't have a right to attorney. Their public defender, one of them can't even talk to them, or they both can't talk to them.
Well, without knowing the specifics of these individual cases, obviously there's a class of cases of which this seems to be a part, of people after September 11th who fall in perhaps a gray area between combatants, because the rules for combatants are very clear over many decades of elaboration during the 20th century. They fall in this gray area between combatants on the one hand and U.S. citizens or persons residing in the United States who are non-combatants on the other hand, and figuring out which is which in this environment where the enemy is organized terrorism is much more difficult than when your enemies are all wearing uniforms. I think we need to stand firm on the basic principle, which is that if you were a non-combatant, then you were treated as such. And the only nub then is determining whether someone is in fact a non-combatant.
So you voted for the Patriot Act. Why?
Because I think that it was scaled back substantially on the questions that we're describing from what originally the administration was seeking. But I objected rather strongly to what the Justice Department had originally sought in legislation. What the Patriot Act ultimately did, which I think needs very much to be done, was modernize the rules on wiretaps. Right now, or I should say just before the Patriot Act, one had to go before a judge to get authorization for a wiretap on the phone rather than on the person. And in an age of cell phones, that's just silly. You know, the question is whether or not you can listen to someone's phone conversations or not, for which judicial approval should be required. The question ought not to be whether you can listen to the conversations of a particular telephone, because if someone steps outside to a phone booth, or if they use a cell phone, or they've got three cell phones, or what have you, that's incidental. The privacy interest belongs to that individual, and the question is whether you can, for legitimate law enforcement reason, intrude upon it. The so-called roving wiretap that follows the person rather than the phone, I think, is a modernization much improved, and that was one of the central changes that was affected by that legislation.
It also cut away rights that permanent residents used to have, right?
Well, this is all in the eye of the beholder, but I think that it struck exactly the right balance and is fully protective of the civil rights of every American and every resident in the United States. I don't think it makes any distinction whatsoever, as a matter of fact, between permanent resident aliens and citizens for purposes of exercising one's civil rights.
Well, I'm a data librarian, actually, also, and here at UCI, and I was concerned about the provision in there for basically opening up surveys and other data collected by the National Center for Educational Statistics. There's a whole provision that says if FBI wants the data from some survey of some college student, they can get it. And that seems to me violates a lot of principles of social science research, confidentiality of respondent data, that kind of stuff. How did that get into that Patriot Act?
Again, I think the distinction is between the privacy interest that we possess as individuals and statistical aggregate information that doesn't implicate any individual or his or her privacy rights. That issue itself, it seems to me, is on the periphery of the main debate that we had in Congress over the Patriot Act, which concerned, for example, the issues such as the roving wiretap that I mentioned, and also funding for counterintelligence in the United States, and the hiring of competent people that can perform these functions, because so little emphasis had been placed on that prior to September 11th. I think that there will now be a much more effective human intelligence staff support, not just in the United States, but across the world as a result of that renewed emphasis. Those are some of the major changes that I think Congress has put in place on a completely bipartisan basis, Democrats and Republicans agreeing on all of these things during the last year.
I guess I don't think it's totally just aggregated. I think it's you know, students could be answering a survey, and maybe the FBI is interested in this particular survey, this particular student, I mean, and try to get what he answered to them. And so I think we may have to disagree on that.
Well, actually, we don't need to disagree on that. If that's in practical effect the way that this might work, then I would object to that provision. I'm not aware of it, but if that's in fact the way it works, then I think that violates the principle that I just enunciated. I think we need to make essentially no exception to the general rule that there is a distinction between what is public and what is private, and if you delve into what is private, you know, beginning with one's home, one's apartment, you know, one's personal effects, the ultimate sanctuary that the law protects us in, and then extending to what, over a period of many years, the courts have come to accept as our sphere of personal privacy. If you intrude upon that, you've got to do it only with judicial process and not something administrative and not some new carved-out exception. And so I don't think I'm prepared to disagree with you on that.
So you think, like, sodomy statutes should be eliminated? I mean, that seems to be a kind of invasion of the bedroom.
I'm sorry, which statutes?
Sodomy.
Sodomy statutes.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, by all means. I mean, these things, I was told recently by Los Angeles Times columnist Dana Parsons, who I was on the phone with, about the laws against gambling that exist still in the state of California and in many states. He brought this to my attention because I had made a wager with San Francisco Congressman Tom Lantos, Democratic congressman who, matter of fact, founded the Congressional Human Rights Caucus, and he and I are both members and work together on human rights issues around the world, and we're very good, close friends. But Congressman Lantos, who incidentally is the only Holocaust survivor to serve in the United States Congress in history, bet me on the World Series. He was for the Giants, and I was, of course, for the Angels. And what he promised to do if the Giants were to lose somehow, from his standpoint, was to stand in front of the United States Capitol, put on a cowboy hat, wear a holster and pistols, and sing Gene Autry's "Back in the Saddle Again." And what I would have to do, if somehow the Angels were to lose, would be to stand in the same spot, wearing a tie-dyed shirt with flowers in my hair, all of that old song, you know, if you go to San Francisco, be sure to wear some flowers in your hair. That may be a little old for college students these days, but you probably heard that on the oldie station. And then sing "I Left My Heart in San Francisco," an even older song. Well, happily, I don't have to do that because the Angels are the world champions, but that wager, it turns out, violates California law. Now, you know, that's one of those things that we just have to update, and perhaps the legislature will someday get around to it. But, you know, for 30-some years, just going back to when I was in law school in the 1970s, nobody has really thought that it's the province of the law to legislate that kind of activity. There is not a sufficient state interest that can be discovered to try and regulate that kind of behavior.
So would you support things like domestic partnership laws?
Yes, the idea is, I think, to give people their legal rights to make sure that people that want to have health care and so on get access to health care. Most of what needs to be accomplished in this area is in the hands of health insurance programs administered by employers and so on, who have all been coming around to this point of view for a period of many years. And the only legal distinction that I think needs to be maintained is legal marriage. And I don't support the notion of changing the definition of marriage from its present definition, because I think that there are good reasons to think that when men and women get married and take on legal rights and responsibilities in the latter category of responsibilities, for example, being responsible for children no matter what, then I think that that is a good foundation that we ought to maintain. But as you know, there is otherwise no real distinction any longer made for purposes of people obtaining legal rights, health insurance, and that sort of thing. Most of that is the province of state law in any case, and the California legislature has gotten to almost all of those issues already.
And the California state law now allows people to register as domestic partners.
Right.
So you're not opposed to that.
No, in fact, the legislation that we considered is something called the Defense of Marriage Act in Congress, which I supported, and that did not in any way interfere with what California has done.
But it did
maintain this definition that I described for marriage as man and woman in the legal union. That is for federal purposes. There are some reasons that we want to have a clear federal definition, and that is, for example, if different states insist that their definition trumps another state's definition, then there's got to be some reconciliation. And for federal purposes, the few areas where federal law requires it, that's the clear definition. But in California, where I live and where all of the listeners to this program live, there's also the opportunity to register as a domestic partner.
So you went gay bashing.
Pardon me?
You went gay bashing when you voted. A lot of people think people that voted for that defense of marriage with gay bashers.
Well, I think that stands reason on its head. I mean, I think that if you are bashing someone and you don't defend their civil rights, and I think I've voted for the Hate Crime Statistics Act. I think it's very important that everybody's civil rights be preserved. But I also observe that there is at least one modest, meaningful distinction that one can make between men and women who are married and others. And so I think that legal definition is fine. But I think everyone, including the substantial number of gay constituents that I represent, deserves to have his or her civil rights protected. And so that's what I'm going to continue to do in Congress.
You know, on the issue of human rights in China, Were you upset that the president of China was chumming up to President Bush? It seems like they're very chummy now. And, does that worry you, or do you like that, or what?
Well, as you know, even though President Zhang is very shortly expected to cede power to Hu Jintao when the Communist Party convenes, he's going to maintain a fair amount of power behind the scenes. He's appointing many of his very close associates to high-level positions, and they will continue on even in a Hu administration. And so I think it's worthwhile for President Bush to have continued close contacts with President Zhang. At all times, with major powers in the world, one of the most important things in diplomacy is to have a short hotline to anybody that's important. And my gosh, I mean, nobody would gainsay the importance of the People's Republic of China these days, or of India, or of Japan, or of our major European allies. And so I think President Bush, in these respects, is doing his job well.
So you don't think you see yourself as bashing China by raising human rights issues there?
No, to the contrary, my main focus when it comes to human rights has been on the commonality of our interests as citizens of the United States and the people of China, as citizens of China and citizens of the world. I think that our Declaration of Independence means what it says when it talks about inalienable rights that belong to everyone. They belong to people who started out in Europe and came to this continent. They belong to people wherever they find themselves. And so while I think there are many variations on the basic theme, and not everyone has to have our Republican style of government that's guaranteed to us in our Constitution, there are some basic rights that people possess that ought to be vindicated. And in many respects, the government of the People's Republic of China denies those rights, particularly when it comes to freedom of the mind, intellectual freedom. When I stand up for Chinese citizens who have their rights taken away when they are exchanging email addresses with one another, for example, when I stand up for people because they simply wrote about democracy, that's their only offense against the government, I'm standing up for Chinese people. Admittedly, I'm criticizing the government of the People's Republic of China, but I see a rather substantial difference there. And that's why people like Liu Qing, who's chairman of Human Rights in China, or Han Dongfang, who's the executive director of the China Labor Bulletin, or Zhao Chang, who's the executive director of Human Rights in China, have all given me awards for my work.
Actually, I interviewed the last person you mentioned a few weeks ago on the show about the AIDS activist who was detained in China.
Yeah, I'm quite a supporter of his and of the work of human rights in China. You know, and when we had a Soviet empire, and when I was working in the White House for President Reagan, I did a substantial amount of work for the people in what were then called the captive nations, the Baltic nations of Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, people in East Germany and Poland and Hungary and so on, Armenia, you go down the list, Bulgaria, and even Russia itself. And none of those people, because I was critical of the government in Moscow, thought that I was anti-Russian or anti-German or anti-Pole or anti-Lithuanian. To the contrary, I got awards from all of those groups for fighting against the human rights abuses of their government. And the same is true now, I think, that those people who are trying to do business with the government of the People's Republic of China sometimes get concerned when human rights issues are brought to the fore. And the easiest attack against those of us who are fighting for human rights is to say that opposition to the policies of the communist government in Beijing is tantamount to being anti-Chinese. But there's a world of difference. And I consider myself to be very, very strongly pro-Chinese.
Do you tie human rights conditions to trade, then?
I do. I think that it's very important that we always, in our relationships, and trade is just a part of a bilateral relationship, keep human rights in the discussion, whether it's a strategic discussion about military forces, whether it's a trade discussion about trade. I think we have the right and the opportunity to raise these things. But I also think that we have to be sensible about it, and we don't want to lose opportunities for incremental change.
But what do you think of the argument from a lot of people that America is actually violating human rights after 9/11 with the Patriot Act?
Well, if you're putting that in the same sentence as supporting human rights in the People's Republic of China, I think that there isn't any question in this country that we have a rule of law and that we have deep and profound respect for the rights of individuals, and that the civil rights that each of us protects, albeit we might, you know, cavil about some actual or potential erosion of it in one or another new piece of legislation, that as we speak in 2002, that we have very sturdy rights as individuals in this country. And so on a relative basis, compared to what your rights would be as a citizen of the PRC, I would say that there isn't much comparison, and that there is room for substantial improvement in China vis-a-vis the United States. I don't think that the moral equivalence there is an acceptable basis for debate. On the other hand, when we get back inside our system here and we're talking about just what goes on inside the four corners of the United States of America, then we have every right as U.S. citizens to say, hey, this isn't even good enough. We want something better. We don't want the kind of inroad that somebody is suggesting into our civil rights, and we're not going to stand for it. And I'm completely sympathetic with that argument.
Well, that's what I'm worried about. That, you know, once some of these laws are institutionalized, it's a slippery slope, isn't it? That once some rights are given up, then they could take it away next time.
Well, that's right, and you always have to be on guard for that. With respect to the Patriot Act, having been through that in excruciating detail in Congress, I will say that a lot of the discussion and a lot of the secondary and tertiary commentary is based upon proposals that were made by the Justice Department, and they were aired over a substantial period of weeks, if not months, and ultimately they were shot down, so that what ultimately became the Patriot Act was nothing like what a lot of people saw and objected to, which is not to say that there aren't portions of the Patriot Act that I myself would rewrite given the opportunity.
But wasn't it true that a lot of the proposals were there, you know, by the FBI before 9/11, and they just took the opportunity to push them forward?
Well, certainly that's true with respect to the roving wiretap that I mentioned. That issue came up, in fact, I was the lead House conferee in a House Senate conference when we were doing an anti-terrorism bill a few Congresses before. That issue came up then. My job at the time was to shoot down the bill that the Clinton administration wanted and that Republicans and Democrats in the Senate wanted, because I thought it was intrusive upon our civil liberties, and I succeeded in doing so. I thought that they were being overbroad at the time, and what we came up with then in the first pass for the Patriot Act were all those same provisions that I objected to the first time around. What we ended up with on roving wiretaps, I think, is exactly what the doctor ordered, which, as I said, permits the judge to issue a warrant that goes to the person that you're seeking to tap rather than a particular cell phone or a particular, you know, phone in his house or his car or what have you.
Back to the campaign, what kind of donations have you been getting, or contributions have you been getting from your supporters? Some critics, like John Graham, argue that you're getting tobacco money, Philip Morris, for instance.
Well, I don't know whether I've gotten money from Philip Morris or not, but I'll tell you my record on tobacco issues is a very strong one. In fact, there was an article in the Washington Post magazine about the tobacco lobbyists in Washington. A secret memo that they had written leaked out to the reporters, and they sized up all the members of Congress as, you know, friend or foe, and they had me on the suspect list because they said I was from California and therefore suspicious and had not voted with them on their smoking legislation. As a matter of fact, when I first came to Congress and served on the Public Works and Transportation Committee, one of the earliest opportunities I had to stake out a position on these tobacco issues came back then. You could still smoke on airplanes. I have to say that I think most of my Republican colleagues were wrong when they thought that this was an issue of choice for consumers, that you ought to be able to smoke or not, because we're all trapped on those airplanes and the non-smokers have rights that get trumped by the smokers. And so I joined with the Democrats and cast the deciding vote in committee that put that legislation on the floor, and you know the result. We successfully banned smoking on airlines, and it's a very good thing. I am a very, very strong proponent of getting smoke out of public places and making sure that people have all adequate education on issues of smoking. I think it's just absolutely absurd that anybody still smokes in America today, but certainly we have a lot of information and resources devoted to making sure that people don't.
So if you found out you did get money from Philip Morris, would you return it?
No, of course not, because well, because it's a conglomerate. It has a lot of interests other than tobacco.
But
and as a matter of fact, you know, even if the Democratic National Committee sent me money, I would probably go ahead and use it, because it doesn't influence, you know, if the DNC gave me money, it doesn't influence my position on smoking or on anything else. I'm going to stand for what I stand for. You know, we have pretty strict limits on what people can donate to federal campaigns. It's not like Gray Davis, who can go out with no rules whatsoever and collect hundreds of thousands of dollars from individual donors. The maximum amount that any individual, including any employee of Philip Morris, can give is $1,000. And so, you know, I just don't operate that way. And no $1,000 contribution or no, you know, accumulated contribution of employees that can get up to $5,000 is going to affect the way I vote in Congress. But I'm happy to take the money of somebody who disagrees with me on an issue and use it for advertising the basis of my positions in Congress. That's what we use the campaign dollars for, is essentially voter outreach.
Your opponent, Professor Graham, has raised the issue of your campaign donation to one Gary Mendoza, who was a lawyer with you, representing a company called First Pension Corporation at one point. And apparently you gave him $125,000 for his insurance commissioner race. He's arguing that this is your connection with a shady kind of shady backroom deals and associations with perpetrators of major frauds.
Well, that is an extraordinary suggestion to make about Gary Mendoza, who is the candidate for insurance commissioner. I've known Gary Mendoza for many, many years. He was the commissioner of corporations for the state of California, did a splendid job. He had responsibility for regulating HMOs. He stood up to Blue Cross Blue Shield, and when they converted from non-profit to for-profit status, required that they disgorge themselves of billions of dollars that have been set up in permanent trust for the people of California. He was the deputy mayor of Los Angeles with Dick Reardon. He was Dick Reardon's law partner. And he has an absolutely 100% blemish-free record. Now, this first pension lawsuit that you mentioned was one that Gary Mendoza won. The lawsuit was thrown out against him. He won the case. I mean, I think for someone to file a lawsuit is fine, and for someone to even repeat the allegations in the complaint is fine, but if later on a judge makes a ruling in that case, then it's beholden upon somebody to mention that fact. And truth is that that is a case that never even got so far as a hearing or trial. It wasn't settled. It was just thrown out with respect to Gary Mendoza and yours truly as well.
Your name was dropped from the case eventually.
Well, sure, because it was a political case. It was brought by a failed Democratic congressional candidate who himself had been sanctioned by the court in a similar case. He named me only after I had brought securities litigation legislation in the United States Congress, which was then before the Energy and Commerce Committee. It was an attempt at intimidation to sue the sponsor of legislation to regulate bad conduct by lawyers. And so not surprisingly, the case got thrown out. It involved a business matter 17 years ago, and it was a transaction that occurred, it was handled by my law firm, but it occurred after I left the firm. And so it was just patently absurd on the face of it. But the judge threw it out, and the lawyer who brought the case had to agree never to sue me again, and did so in return for my promising not to sue him for malicious prosecution. That's the kind of thing that you need to get the rest of the story on, and the short answer is I've won that case. It's the only time that anybody's ever sued me in my entire life.
Graham also argues that at the same time you were trying to, and you did get this law passed that that limited shareholder rights and it made it more difficult for shareholders to sue executives for fraud, thereby opening the floodgates for corporate misbehavior such as WorldCom and Merrill Lynch, Arthur Anderson. And WorldCom has donated thousands of dollars to your campaign, he says.
Well, that stands, again, reason, logic, and truth on its head. The truth is that in 1995, the Securities Litigation Reform Act was passed by more than two-thirds majorities of both the House and the Senate. Ted Kennedy voted for it. Dianne Feinstein voted for it. It was completely bipartisan. And the reason is that it reined in lawyer abuses and gave new rights to plaintiffs, shareholders in cases, where they were being ripped off by their lawyers. So the class of people that didn't like this legislation was the regulated class, the small group of unethical lawyers who were bringing these kinds of cases that took bread off the table of deserving plaintiffs. This law now will have effect in the Enron class action, and it's going to mean hundreds of millions, indeed probably billions of extra dollars for the plaintiffs in that case. Let me give you a very specific example of how this law works. Prior to its passage in 1995, a class action lawyer, someone who represents not just you and me, but a whole class of people similarly situated whom he's never met, but claims to be suing on behalf of, could raise a claim, perhaps a modest claim of a few hundred dollars or a few thousand dollars per person, but you know, cumulatively, additively, it would be a whole lot. And then he could say, I want 25% of that amount. He would then settle the case with the people that he was suing, and the settlement would give him a lot of money and all the members of the plaintiff class almost nothing at all. That abuse was rampant prior to 1995. In the Enron class action, the first thing that occurred because of this new law is that the court, no longer the lawyer, got to pick who would be the representative lead plaintiff in the case. So instead of a tame plaintiff who is the close friend or associate of the lawyer bringing the case, as used to be the collusive practice prior to 1995, now the judge, the court, picks who the lead plaintiff is, and in the Enron class action, they picked the University of California, the UC Regents. That's who the plaintiff is. And the first thing that the UC Regents did, as plaintiffs in this case, is knock down the contingent fee lawyer's claim for a fee from 25% to 8%. And since this case involves so much money, as I say, that's probably worth well over $1 billion to the plaintiffs in the case. Another important aspect of this 1995 law that I wrote, or at least was the main author of, there's a whole title of the law which imposes new duties on auditors to discover and report fraud. In fact, that is the name of the title, Duty of Auditors to Discover and Report Fraud. This is a new federal law that Anderson violated, and it's a new way that the government and private plaintiffs will have to go after auditors who are committing these abuses. It prefigured very presciently what went on in the Enron case, and it's a good thing that we have that law now for the protection of shareholders. So it is very vitally needed reform, and it's something that I'm very proud of having worked on.
So you disagree that the LA Times, with the headline saying that this law, this Reform Act, provided or is said to provide safe harbor for fraud?
Well, of course, I strongly disagree with that. To the contrary, it is one of the major protections that we now have against this kind of fraud. And I've got a very big stack of articles, including articles from the Los Angeles Times, that said so.
But why would Arthur Anderson lobby for that bill if they ended up being caught by it?
Well, because Arthur Anderson ended up in the Enron matter and in other matters violating the very law. I mean, I don't know why they violated the law, why they thought it might be good business, why they lost control of their partners and so on, but I mean, the answer is that it was good law. It imposed upon accountants new duties. They then proceeded to violate that very law. But Arthur Anderson, to the extent it was obeying the law, and all of us thought at one time that that was a very respectable firm, Arthur Anderson, to the extent that it was obeying the law, would want to make sure that good cases in which they or their clients were plaintiffs could proceed to court and get higher settlements or quicker judgments, and that frivolous lawsuits would be weeded out. Nobody thinks that the cases against Arthur Anderson or against Enron are anything like frivolous, and there's no question that they deserve to have the book thrown at them.
Back to the issue of education versus I guess spending on the military. I think Graham argues that instead of this war economy, we should try to, instead of being a garrison state, we should spend money on education, more time on education, more resources. And so, I mean, I know you said at the beginning that because of your position, you're able to direct resources to UCI, for instance, at the federal level. how do you respond to the argument that, you know, if we go to war with Iraq, less will be available for education?
I don't disagree with that. I, as a matter of fact, as a former teacher, I strongly believe that we've got to look at education as an investment, and that if we don't invest now in our young people, that we're going to have hell to pay, particularly in the state of California. We have a much younger population than other economies our size. We're the fifth largest economy on Earth, and in part because of the substantial migration from Mexico, Central, and South America in this country, we have a lower average age. This is a big benefit for our state because in Japan or in Germany, and even in the rest of the United States, demographic changes are taking Social Security programs to the brink, and we have no way without an adequate influx of new younger workers to sustain these programs. In California, we don't have this problem necessarily if we can educate our workforce and if we can view all these young people as an asset. But if we don't make that investment in education, then I think our future will be very bleak indeed. And in addition to having an aging population that is going to make increasing demands on social services, Medicare, Social Security, and so on, we're also going to have a workforce of somewhat younger people, young adults, who are uneducated and unable to pay the taxes that are necessary to sustain these programs. So just for the future of our state and for the future of our country, I can think of nothing more important than investing in education. And if that's my opponent's point of view, then I just happen to share that completely. And I also agree that there is really no economic upside other than the fact that we remain alive and intact to spending money on military conflict or to spending money on security that deters conflict. It's no more economically productive than the money we spend to put locks on our doors. We do it because we have to, not because it creates jobs.
Do you still believe in Star Wars then?
Pardon me?
Do you still believe in spending on Star Wars missile defense?
No, of course not. The Star Wars pejorative, which was applied to a proposed system that would intercept a Soviet first strike, has long since landed on the ash heap. Instead, the missile defense program that is now supported by Democrats and Republicans in Congress, and hugely supported, almost unanimously, in the vote that we had just a few weeks ago, is focused on intercepting the rogue missile, the terrorist missile. It would be ineffective against a state-sponsored attack by any state that has any significant kind of arsenal. But it would be an effective way to protect our country from the very realistic threat that we are increasingly facing from terrorist groups that, such as Al-Qaeda, who are laying their hands on nuclear materials. I don't know if you've seen the articles in the paper in recent days documenting the fact that Al-Qaeda, in fact, does have a nuclear weapons capability, that they almost certainly have the capacity to produce a dirty bomb, and that they're working on something more sophisticated even than that.
So do you think, on that point about nuclear technology, do you think you would, what would you do in terms of Iraq? Are you supporting going slow and finding out what they have, or do you want to go in and bomb them?
With Iraq, we have a limited opportunity because Iraq has not yet perfected a nuclear weapon, although, or at least to the extent of our intelligence, we have not verified that they have done so. But they are working on it, and they are getting close. They have a known capacity for chemical and biological weapons, and Saddam Hussein has, in fact, used those weapons. We need to do everything that we can, if we're concerned about nuclear proliferation, to arrest his progress while there is still time. And so that is why the United States is attempting to lead a coalition of the world to stand up for the UN resolutions, 16 of which Saddam Hussein has violated. Only a resolution that is backed by a credible threat of force is going to work, because the other 16 have failed. They've been toothless and flaccid, and we've had predictable results. In order for the threat of force to be credible, we had to go through the whole debate in Congress about whether, if pressed, if Saddam Hussein were to reject a 17th UN resolution, we would use that force. And so we did so. That is now a very credible threat of force, but I hope that we don't have to use force.
Well, on that point, I want to thank you very much. I think we're out of time. Thank you, Congressman Cox, for being on the show.
I'm happy to join you anytime, and I'm
great.
Particularly pleased that this is UCI production, because as a 14-year honorary anteater, I have a longer association with UCI than any education institution in the United States.
And I've seen you at GPACS meetings.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.